From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a conversation with Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who is in the nation's capital for the swearing-in of President Joe Biden.
It is important for the United States to see that we won't let what truly is a small number of domestic terrorists undermine this fundamental moment.
Also, Donald Trump commutes former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's prison term. One reporter talks to us about the Kilpatrick years.
I think a lot of the conversation right now is about why would Trump do this?
Plus, with criminal charges filed against former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, we'll talk about when and how elected officials are investigated.
If all you could charge the governor with after 7 years is a misdemeanor, it sounds like you didn't have a whole lot against him, and it's just a symbolic effort.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we revisit Kwame Kilpatrick and what he meant to Detroit.
You have people who said, you know, he was corrupt, he needed to go down. And then you have people who say, look, yes, Kwame was wrong, but 28 years is too long.
Kilpatrick is a free man today after former President Donald Trump commuted his prison term. More on that coming up later in the show. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer was among the leaders who gathered in the U.S. Capitol today for the swearing-in of our 46th president. Joe Biden got support from Gretchen Whitmer throughout his campaign. And many are hoping that his ascension to the Oval Office might mean a stronger standing for Michigan. We caught up with Governor Whitmer to talk about her part in preparing for this day and some pressing issues for Michigan. Governor Whitmer, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
You are one of the co-chairs of the Presidential Inauguration Committee. For the layperson, could you run us through what responsibilities you had and some of the challenges you had to contend with? There's so much going on right now with security and public health.
Well, sure. In a normal year, being on the Presidential Inaugural Committee, I think, brings all sorts of opportunities for to get together with folks and to help people get tickets and to plan out what the ceremony looks like. And certainly in this year with COVID-19 and the really kind of tough political environment that we have and with the domestic terrorist attack on our United States Capitol, it's just got to look a lot different. And that's okay. You know, our goal was to make sure that we honor the inaugural traditions, that we showcase the strength and resilience of our nation, and that we bring Americans together to mark a new beginning. And I know that's what President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris, President Biden and Vice President Harris today, will be working toward at every turn.
In terms of security, I heard that there are now more military boots on the ground in the District of Columbia than in both Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Is that true?
I can't tell you for sure if that's true. I've heard that same figure. I can just tell you that the United States Secret Service has been overseeing the security. The peaceful transfer of power is a cornerstone of our democracy and our leadership in the world. And we are committed to that. And hopefully this moment is a real opportunity for us all Americans and people who reside in the United States of America to recognize that's what binds us, and that's what should be paramount as we look to the future of our nation for ourselves, for our kids and future generations of Americans.
I think it can be argued that we have not had a peaceful transfer of power to this point. So many people were rattled by what happened at the Capitol. Can you let us in on why the decision was made to continue with the pageantry of a presidential inauguration? Is the risk of an open ceremony that important?
I really believe that the Secret Service has done a great deal to mitigate the risk, that it is important for the United States to see that we won't let what truly is a small number of domestic terrorists undermine this fundamental moment. And even if the outgoing president doesn't want to honor their traditions, the rest of us will rise to this moment, and we will put this democracy ahead of our individual needs, our partisan goals, that we will say this country that we are all so fortunate to call home is paramount, and that we honor this moment, but we get right to work. And I know that many new administrations have a little bit of a honeymoon, That's not going to be the case here because Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are inheriting a great deal of strife and crisis, but I know that they're ready to work on day one, and they will.
President Biden chose you to be vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. And the Democratic Party has been experiencing a split over the past couple of years between its moderate and progressive wings. And so far, the party's been able to hold it together. But there are many people worried about the risk of it fracturing irreparably, as we've seen happening on the right between moderates, conservatives, and Trump loyalists. How do you think the Democratic Party avoids that fate?
I think it's by staying tethered to the realities that American families and American businesses are confronting every single day. One of the things that was so important as I ran for governor was actually getting around the state and talking to everyone, getting into all 83 counties in Michigan, having those conversations. And I'm continuing it as governor, staying tethered to what's going to improve people's lives, engaging with folks so that they, you know what they are worried about, so you can focus on solving problems, I think is the bread and butter of the Democratic Party. And certainly it is a big tent. It always has been. That's one of the reasons I love being associated with this party. But we're going to push and pull one another a bit. But I think so long as we stay focused on what really is meaningful in terms of creating paths to opportunity for everyone, we are going to continue to have opportunities to drive the agenda. And I think that's absolutely crucial.
Governor Whitmer, I wanted to ask a question about the aftermath of the insurrection at the Capitol. We hear reports that the Pentagon is cleaning house with respect to people who participated and who took part in violent acts at the Capitol. Same goes for law enforcement all around the country right now. You understand the threat of anti-government and white supremacist actors, maybe more than most. And yet at the same time, we all have this reality that police oversight is such a local matter and locally controlled. What should be happening in Michigan right now to make sure that the people who are protecting us have a clear view of what the country's best interests are?
I can just say this. When we saw those horrifying pictures out of our nation's capital a couple of weeks ago, and I heard people saying, oh, I can't believe this is happening. All I could think was, well, then they haven't been paying attention. We saw this play out in Michigan 10 months ago. We saw this kind of, you know, behavior where people were showing up with automatic rifles going into the state capitol to intimidate lawmakers. That was happening in Michigan 10 months ago. Some of those very same people were indicted in a plot to kidnap and kill me. When the leader in the White House continues to foment the vitriol and the hate and give license to people that are intent on doing domestic terror to their fellow Americans, it is a dangerous moment. And it is incumbent that we know and have confidence in that our law enforcement is going to remember their oaths to our nation and be of the caliber people that we hope and expect to be in law enforcement, not sympathizers to groups that are trying to undermine our democracy and the very constitution that law enforcement officers take an oath to, and that all, frankly, all office holders do. So I do think that accountability is incredibly important in this moment. I'm glad to see law enforcement agencies doing the hard work of identifying people that were at that Capitol insurrection and that they will move forward and press charges. I think that that's appropriate, and I think it's absolutely important for us to have accountability. We have to continue moving forward, but those systems have to work as well, and they are moving forward, and I'm glad to see it.
Last question, Governor. I have to ask about the status of COVID-19 vaccines in Michigan. We know that there have been many, many issues trying to get enough doses and coordinating among counties. And just recently, we got news that there basically is no national stockpile for Michigan and other states to fall back on. You've said you want school districts to try to give a face-to-face learning option in March. Do you think that that's still a realistic goal, given what we know about vaccine administration?
I think it's a realistic goal because what we know is that if people follow the protocols If schools follow the protocols, we can avoid spread in our schools. Even if we haven't gotten to 100% of teachers and staff in our schools vaccinated, we know, having been through this for 10 months, that there has been in-person instruction in many places throughout this whole pandemic. And we've not seen the massive numbers of COVID cases that some thought we might. Certainly, I was worried that we would. The fact of the matter is, if people can space out and wear their masks universally throughout the day, that we can resume some in-person teaching without increasing the potential of COVID spread. Even if we were able to get 100% of our teachers and staff vaccinated next week, we would still need to follow these protocols, because this remains a novel virus that is mutating, and until we get to at least 70% of our population vaccinated, we've got to adopt these protocols and live with them.
Obviously, schools won't get to 100% vaccination for their staff by March 1st, but the case that comes to my mind is Detroit. I mean, we don't even know if there's enough for, you know, maybe 25% or 10% of those teachers to get vaccinated. The Free Press has been reporting there are huge delays in the program. You're going to stick by this recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, it's a recommendation. So first, let's make sure that that I reiterate that. It's a recommendation that we prioritize in-person learning, and that they have a plan that they have put out to their public. It's not an order. It is a recommendation. We know that the learning loss our kids are experiencing is real and will take years to remediate. Many school districts have kept kids in the classroom and have not had major outbreaks, and it's because they're following the protocols. And so what we have encouraged districts to do is to come up with a plan, to work with their educators on it, their parents. That's really important. But prioritizing in-person learning is something that really is critical for the kids, and can be done safely, because we've seen that happen in districts all across the country who've stayed in person throughout the virus coming to the United States.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer, thank you very much for making some time for us.
Thank you.
Governor Whitmer is in Washington, D.C. today for the presidential inauguration. In a moment, we'll have some analysis of the latest criminal charges for the Flint water crisis, including the state's first charges against a former governor.
It seems as if it were just an attempt to throw some mud on Governor Snyder 2.5 years after he's been out of office.
That's after the break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last week, when several former state officials were charged by special prosecutors with crimes related to the Flint water case, the most eye-popping part of the story was that former Governor Rick Snyder was among those charged. Snyder is facing 2 misdemeanors and pled not guilty. The pollution of Flint's water, which came about as part of a bungled effort to save the city money, is one of the most catastrophic environmental and public health incidents in state history. We explored some reaction to the charges on our show last week. If you missed it, we talked with Flint's mayor, an investigative journalist, and a prosecutor who worked on the initial inquiry. They all felt like the charges are a step in the right direction. Since then, several prominent state officials and attorneys have argued that charging Snyder sets a troubling precedent that would defy the nature and purpose of government immunity. One of those attorneys warning of the fallout is Mike Nichols, a Lansing-based lawyer who has represented several lawmakers in court. Mike Nichols, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
Set the table for us. What is government immunity, and what's the legal footing that it occupies?
Well, you know, April, it's had a lot of discussion and public interest in the context of the racial justice movement and qualified immunity for law enforcement officers, which is a different type of immunity. That's immunity from a civil suit for acts that you undertake while you're basically on the job, so long as they're not grossly negligent. In this context, we're talking about charging somebody with a crime for decisions that they made, in this case of a public official, while in office. An incredibly slippery, the slipperiest of slopes, and to my way of thinking, very problematic And especially as we look down the road, people have already started assessing, okay, what about some of the decisions that, for example, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has made during the pandemic?
You say that charging Rick Snyder is a slippery slope. Why do you say that? I mean, you mentioned Governor Whitmer and the choices being made during the pandemic right now, but why wouldn't you hold elected officials to that standard?
The reason is because, and I understand the great concern that you did this and lives were lost, and so you have to be held accountable. But the problem is, first of all, no one is going to want to hold public office at that level. And on a secondary level, if you're in public office, you're not going to want to make any decisions that have any risk whatsoever, even though the decision that you make that's risk adverse is completely contrary to what's in the best interest for public policy.
How can you know that? Might it not also be possible that elected officials would take the best legal and scientific advice that was available to them and then go ahead with making a decision? Would there not be legal defense possible based on that?
That question is premised on the idea that that did not happen in this case. Because, you know, data can be omnidirectional. And from having represented witnesses who were DEQ employees 3 years ago when the Todd Flood investigation, we'll call it, was ongoing, I can tell you, you know, without talking about inappropriate facts, but the data clearly was omnidirectional. And decisions that were made by people, from what I was able to see, while they may have not been correct or accurate all the way down the line, the point is, if you make a mistake when you're a public official, an office holder, or a civil servant, both of those categories included, you're protected from criminal prosecution, even if the result is really, really bad.
Mike, we had attorney Noah Hall on the program last week, and he worked on the Flint investigation for the state before being released by Attorney General Dana Nessel. And he made the point that we're not just talking about somebody making a mistake. He believes that prosecutors are going to be able to prove that there was a conspiracy and that he would hope that any decision by the courts would be based on that. He also said the charges are an important step to show that officials at all levels of government are not above the law. Does this case pose the same slippery slope problem if there is not, in fact, a conviction in the case?
Well, if there's not a conviction in the case, I contend that there will be no winners, because Rick Snyder and the others who've been charged, Nick Lyon and Howard Croft and the others, will have gone through such anxiety to deal with not just the criminal court and whether or not any of them are going to go to jail, but just the whole public specter and spectacle. And really, I think charging in this particular situation, unless I hear something different, I mean, even if there is a conspiracy to do what exactly, I guess, is my concern. There's conspiracy all the time in politics.
Conspiracy to conceal what state health and environmental officials were actually saying to the public about the safety of their water.
I will say this, and I'm uniquely situated. I may not have as much information as Attorney Hall, but again, the data was not, it's not all pointing in one direction that this was the Flint River or the treatment plant. There were a lot of other sources that I think, you know, pretty hardworking and concerned civil servants were trying to figure out what that was. And from what I think we'll see, I'll put it that way, is that there was debate and discussion and no consensus about what exactly was going on. And the obvious concern going the other way is, you know, do we generate a needless public hysteria? Harken back to the mid-70s and Bill Milliken's handling of the PBB crisis. If history were to look back at Bill Milliken's mistakes that he made, and they were very similar to what your point was, that there was concealment or a lack of disclosure of the problem, you know, would we charge Bill Milliken with a crime for misconduct in office because he miscalculated when to disclose to the public exactly what was going on with PBB in the food chain? I think not.
I take your point about the concern that public officials might not want to serve, but is there any kind of tipping point in your mind at which the seriousness of the events merits a full serious consideration of how our elected officials are responding to them? I mean, I think people in Flint would argue that the distress of a public official or the concern of public hysteria can indeed be weighed against the distress of an entire community that has been suffering from the effects of lead poisoning and children whose brains have been truly damaged by this, and the fact that there is no medical intervention that's ever going to make their lives the same again, the deaths caused by Legionnaire's disease. In your mind, is there any line at which a government official should be held criminally accountable?
Well, the line is where the public official commits crimes that have absolutely no rational relationship to the duties of his office. The historical example that we have most recently is Richard Nixon and Watergate. That's the line.
Can you explain how you see what Rick Snyder's role was in this situation did not rise to that level? I mean, he was the sitting governor of the state.
What I have seen, both from having served as a lawyer as part of the investigation and from what I've read, and now this discounts things that may have happened after all of the investigation and the crisis, the perjury allegations for, you know, making knowing inaccurate statements under oath, setting that aside, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what I think we're going to hear and see is this was deliberation over what's the right thing to do. And if there's something that comes out that says, I think because the Democrats are going to make political hay about this, we need to let hundreds of people get sick and potentially die, and some did, then perhaps that's the differentiation. But I haven't heard or seen that yet, and I don't know that we will. And, you know, knowing Rick Snyder and the people who he surrounded himself with, I never perceived him to be that type of personality. He cared about the office and serving the state, you know, politics aside, not taking advantage of a situation where people were going to die and knowingly walking the other way and knowing the risk that decisions or lack of decisions, knowing that that risk was probably going to happen. I just don't think we're going to see that evidence.
Mike Nichols, attorney, is based in Lansing. Mike, thank you very much for talking through these issues with us.
April, thank you for having me.
We wanted the perspective of someone who's thought a lot about when and how to investigate elected officials when there's a possibility of crimes having been committed. Mike Cox is the former Michigan Attorney General, and he joins us now. Mike, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me on, April.
As Attorney General, how did you balance the specter of possible criminal activity on the part of an elected official with the privilege of government immunity? Where was the line for you?
I think the first thing I tried to keep first and foremost in my mind is, as a prosecutor, your job is first and foremost to do justice. It's not to win. It's to do justice to both sides, meaning would-be defendants as well as plaintiffs, or in criminal cases, that's the people. And so I had been a 13-year career prosecutor when I ran for attorney general. And when I ran and won, I really wasn't a career politician. So it was really easy for me to keep that first rule in front of me, which was to first do justice. So what does that mean in the political situation? It means that you have to understand that incompetence is not a crime, that ineptness is not a crime. So as a result, you know, you follow the facts and apply the law, and then you reach a conclusion.
How does the Attorney General's office manage to conduct investigations into public officials while maintaining some discretion? I know that grand juries can be conducted in relative secrecy. Are there other tools that make it possible beyond just human discretion?
Well, no. I mean, if you mean by human discretion, meaning a person at the Attorney General's office makes the call, should we go forward or not? Depending on the importance of the case, they run it up through the chain of command to the Attorney General. You know, grand juries, that's discretion too, in the case involving Governor Snyder. in the former members of his administration. That was a one-person grand jury, a judge who made the calls. So what happened there is that a prosecutor would present evidence, submitted evidence either through live witnesses or documents, and then ask for certain charges. And then in that case, the judge made a call. Normally, most of the cases, even public corruption or the prosecution of public officials in the attorney general's office, it's just an assistant attorney general and her or his boss, you know, will make the main call and sometimes running up the flagpole. Every prosecution is by its very nature has discretion in it. That helps.
You've said that the charges against former Governor Rick Snyder are, in your view, a slippery slope. Can you say a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So after 7 years, first investigations under investigative subpoena by Bill Schuette and Todd Flood, and then subsequently a grand jury investigation, we now have a number of serious felonies against people who are on the ground, who made direct decisions and who had the most access to the facts. And I don't know enough about those, but on the one hand, you charge people with 15-year involuntary manslaughter charges. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you end up charging the former governor of the state of Michigan, the first governor charged for something he did in office in the 184 years existence of our state, with a misdemeanor. After 7 years, it just seems beside the point. It seems as if it were just an attempt to throw some mud on Governor Snyder now 2.5 years after he's been out of office. That really cannot be about meeting the ends of justice, because that won't bring justice to any of the people of Flint. I view it as a symbolic effort. And it seems more petulant than driven by the facts and the law. Because one other thing here, April, is that if all you could charge the governor with after 7 years is a misdemeanor, it sounds like you didn't have a whole lot against him. And it's just a symbolic effort.
Isn't it the case that prosecutors will sometimes file charges that are different from the actual crimes because they have a larger picture of negotiating terms of charges for an entire group of people who might be involved in an incident, though?
Yes. And in fact, there are times when prosecutors will only charge one out of 100 people that could be charged to send a message. That's not unethical because they can't charge all 100, but they want to send a message that certain behavior is illegal and they won't tolerate it. But April, this really is the case. Again, two misdemeanors are so inconsequential and it really seems more driven by we have to charge the governor with something and we ethically can't, you know, charge him with a felony. When governors have been charged in the United States before, all across the country, the most recent Rob Blagojevich next door in Illinois, a number of people. Generally, when governors are charged, it's with the crime involving bribery. There's nothing like that here. It's just you should have known better. As a policy matter, Governor Snyder, you should have known better. And I fear that use of the criminal law by prosecutors.
When we talk about the political dimension of this, this is a situation where Bill Schuette, a Republican, and Dana Nessel, a Democrat. These are two state attorney generals. Both saw fit to launch major investigations into Flint. And we have an entire city dealing with the realities of the poison in their water. Is there something here that goes beyond politics?
Well, I had no problem with the investigations. In fact, when Lieutenant Governor Calley attacked A.G. Schuette about investigating it, I defended Bill Schuette. My point is simply now that we're at the end of the line, this charge is so inconsequential. After 7 years of charge and misdemeanor, is like it really seems to reflect the feeling like, well, we had to charge him with something. You know, we couldn't charge him with involuntary manslaughter. We couldn't even charge him with misconduct in office. Let's keep looking in the book to find something to stick on him. That's my fear. Now, it may be that I'm wrong after all the facts come out, that somehow I'm wrong. But having been around criminal prosecutions for 30 years now, that's how I view it. That's what the facts suggest to me. And that's in my bones how I feel. You know, there is no evidence that Attorney General Schuette was going to charge the governor with any crime. And believe me, there is no love lost between those two, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Mike, one last question. We woke up to news this morning that Kwame Kilpatrick's sentence was commuted by President Trump. This is, of course, the former mayor of Detroit, and someone that you had to investigate on separate matters during your term as Attorney General. Do you have any thoughts about his release?
I really don't, April. I know a lot of people will be mad. A number of people will be happy. We investigated him a couple times, and when it would have been politically popular to charge him early on for some of his tomfoolery, we didn't, because the law wouldn't allow us. The facts wouldn't allow us. In terms of the commutation, you know, we see Mayor Duggan was supportive of it. Anytime when I was in the prosecutor's office, when someone got sentenced, I'd always think of, I did 3 years in the Marine Corps. And if anyone ever went to prison for more than 3 years, I felt mentally, boy, that's a long time. So he did 8 years, whether that's the right amount or not, that was the president's call, but he got punished and he'll carry that mark forever, as he should. And hopefully he'll turn himself around.
Mike Cox is a former attorney general for the state of Michigan. Mike, thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Take care. It's good talking to you, April.
Up next, former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick received one of a flurry of pardons and commutations issued by Donald Trump during his last hours as president.
You know, there were a lot of very good things that happened under Kwame Kilpatrick because he was listening to regular folk.
In a moment, we'll speak with a longtime Detroit journalist about how Kilpatrick's conviction shaped politics in the city. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Former President Donald Trump commuted the prison sentence of Detroit's ex-mayor Kwame Kilpatrick on his way out of office today. Kilpatrick had served about 7 years of a 28-year sentence for corruption. The announcement, very, very early this morning, was part of a flurry of clemency action. A White House statement noted that prominent members of the Detroit community had supported commuting the former mayor's sentence, and that while in prison, Kilpatrick had, quoting here, taught public speaking classes and led Bible study groups with his fellow inmates. Kwame Kilpatrick was convicted in 2013 of racketeering, conspiracy, fraud, extortion, and some tax crimes. With us today is Chastity Pratt. Right now, she's an education bureau chief at the Wall Street Journal, but she's been working in Detroit for a long time. And she was a reporter at the Detroit Free Press for a period of the Kwame Kilpatrick administration. Chastity Pratt, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi.
You know, it's been a while. A lot of people might know who Kwame is, but they might not remember the exact details of what landed him in jail. Can you run us through what led to his conviction?
Oh, yeah. So Kwame Kilpatrick, like you said, was this rising political star in the late 90s in Michigan. From 97 to 2001, he was in the state legislature, sort of following in his mom's footsteps because she was a congresswoman. Then 2001, he finds himself elected mayor of the city of Detroit at the age of 31. So from there, like, almost immediately, there was an air of controversy following him. Some people thought, oh, he was arrogant and young and brash and not deserving of his title and his office. Other people in Detroit, young voters, really turned out saying it's our turn, young people, to lead the city. And he had a lot of support. But, you know, 2002, very early in his, you know, mayorship, he's accused of having a wild party at the Manoogian mayor's mansion. It became the thing of legend and lore, and the city started investigating whether or not, you know, there was this wild party at the mansion. And what we see happening in, I believe it was it 2008? Yeah, 2008, there's this whistleblower lawsuit. The investigator, Gary Brown, and another police officer, Nelthrop, they essentially say Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick fired them or retaliated against them because they were investigating the party, the alleged Manoogian Mansion party. So they sue the city. And in that court case, Kwame Kilpatrick is later found to perjured himself. So therein begins like this long saga that that turns into court case after court case after court case, dealing with corruption. Every seems like everyone in his circle is pulled in it, from his father to his best friends. And here, like you said, in October 2013, after spending more than a year in jail for some of these smaller convictions, 2013, the big conviction goes through. He's convicted of 24 counts of federal corruption charges and gets a 28-year sentence.
Yeah. Kwame Kilpatrick became a vessel through which people channeled so many emotions about Detroit and its leadership. This was true for Black Detroiters. This was true for white Detroiters. And people from outside the city just loved to opine about him. What is your take on why Kwame Kilpatrick was such a polarizing figure?
I would say because Detroit is very racially polarized, you're always have had and, you know, who knows for how long we'll continue to have people on different racial sides of just about every argument, right? So you have people who said, you know, he was corrupt, he needed to go down. And then you have people who say, look, yes, Kwame was wrong, but 28 years is too long. And that he was over sentenced because he was young Black man.
Right. I mean, he's not to interrupt, but Kilpatrick's lawyers, just to explain, had asked for a 15-year sentence, and prosecutors went for almost double that. And, you know, the people will remember there were folks asking, you know, would a white defendant accused of the same crime been given the same sentence? Do you think perceptions of his sentencing have changed over the past couple of years?
I don't know that perceptions have changed. Like a lot of political issues in our society, people look for confirmation of their own bias. You know, when Kwame Kilpatrick in 2019 writes to President Trump and says, "You're the greatest president ever, please let me out." And basically Trump ignored him. There were some people saying, well, that's the critics and opponents of Kwame Kilpatrick were saying, you know, that there he is again. There he goes again. He's arrogant. He's brash. He'll do anything that he has to benefit himself. And then you have some people saying, well, look, it was a very smart thing. He's shrewd and he should not be there for 28 years. Of course, he's going to write that letter. And I think that those, you know, people who are on either side of the Kwame Kilpatrick conundrum are probably not going to be swayed off of their opinions by what's happened with his commutation.
Have you heard much reaction today in Detroit?
You know, there have been several instances of people saying, Kwame's getting out, Kilpatrick's getting out. You know, it's funny because people who call him Kwame, some people do it in a way that is, you know, friendly, and some do it as a way to disrespect him. But, you know, several times there have been rumors that Kilpatrick was going to be released. And just around November, there was rumors that he was going to be released. And so in the last few hours since it's happened, I've been watching social media a lot. And again, the people who say he should be gone are like, yay, he's getting out. And the others are saying who think, you know, he was very corrupt and should still be there, saying shame, shame, shame. Of course, Trump would do something like this. I think a lot of the conversation right now is about why would Trump do this?
Yeah. Chastity, as somebody who was writing about the city in the years after Kwame Kilpatrick left office, and just as someone who's been living in the city all this time, do you think the conviction of this former mayor and others in his circle, do you think it changed anything about the political culture of the city?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you don't get a white suburban man to become mayor of the city of Detroit if not for Kwame Kilpatrick, right? You know, since I had been born, there had been a Black mayor in the city of Detroit. And then all of this corruption stuff happens with Kwame Kilpatrick, and you have people saying, well, you know, the city is in turmoil, not only politically after the Kilpatrick scandal, but financially, because we were going through the biggest municipal bankruptcy in the history of America. So people were saying, look, well, maybe it's time for a well-connected white guy who knows rich people to come in and become, you know, mayor. So You don't have that without a Kwame Kilpatrick scandal happening and without the bankruptcy that happened afterward. And, you know, there were a lot of very good things that happened under Kwame Kilpatrick, which is why he was reelected in 2005, right on the heels of a couple smaller scandals. Because there were some things that he was listening to regular folk, right? They said they wanted their parks cleaned up. He said, let's do it, you know, and just very close to the bone issues. He, you know, listened to people and they appreciated that. You know, we had the Super Bowl, we had the Final Four. But the other thing that happened was he signed the swaps deal. Huge loan to refinance the city's debt. And at the time, the financial world celebrated him for it. But we know now that it was one of the biggest problems that led to the city's bankruptcy.
Speaking of Mayor Duggan, as you did a moment ago, I see he sent his congratulations to Kwame Kilpatrick today. What's that about?
I would totally be just guessing. But again, you have to realize Kwame Kilpatrick still has supporters in the city of Detroit. You know, all those people who signed that letter asking for his commutation. You know, you had Sherry Dagnogo, who was a rep and is on a school board. There were a lot of people who still support Kwame Kilpatrick. So it makes sense not to start a fight where you don't have one if you're, yeah, Duggan.
Chastity Pratt is a former reporter for the Detroit Free Press. You can read her today in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. She's their education bureau chief. Chastity, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime.
One final note. For those who are wondering, Kwame Kilpatrick is barred from holding office for 20 years after his conviction. That means that in the year 2033, the road would be clear if he wished to return to politics. 50 years ago today, Marvin Gaye's single What's Going On was released. And boy, does this song still resonate.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
We wanted to talk about the history of this epic song. With us today is Ann DeLisi, host of Ann DeLisi's Essential Music on WDET. So What's Going On represented a significant shift into the political, both for Marvin and for Motown in general. What was going on with Marvin Gaye at this time in his life that made him want to put out a song like that?
Well, one of the things that inspired it was his brother was serving in Vietnam.
You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
And so he was, you know, mindful and moved by that. But when it came time to do this album, he was ready for a change. You know, his entire life had been going in a different direction, and his music certainly followed that. He wasn't even going to record this song himself originally. He wasn't going to be the one. He wanted to produce it, but he didn't want to be the singer and perform it. It was actually intended for the Four Tops because it was written by one of the Four Tops, Obie Benson. And the Tops thought it was too political. I think they even tried to get Joan Baez to record it, and she turned it down as well. So eventually, Marvin Gaye ended up recording it, and it was written by Marvin Gaye and Obie Benson, and they, and Al Cleveland, I should also mention, he wrote it as well. So the three of them wrote this song, and it was inspired by the police brutality that Obie Benson witnessed. So Marvin Gaye had these feelings about his brother being in Vietnam, and Obie Benson saw this police brutality that was put upon these anti-war protesters.
Oh, but who would they judge us?
So Berry Gordy was on board with this. This was someone who built his empire primarily on dance tunes and love ballads.
I think that Berry Gordy thought it was one of the worst songs he ever heard, and he had no interest in putting it out. And Marvin said that God, you know, this album was written, this song was written by God, that this was something that he was called to write. and he wasn't going to budge on it. Actually, he refused to record another note until this song was put out. And they sort of went around Berry Gordy. Harry Balk, who was the head of A&R at Motown Records, connected with Barney Ailes, who was in charge of distribution, sales and distribution, and knew how to get airplay. It was Barney Ailes who got it printed, you know, he got it pressed, I should say, and got it to a bunch of radio stations. And I think the day they put it out, it sold 100,000 copies. And then it just went from there, and it became a million seller.
Incredible. What did it take in terms of getting the song made? Was there anything else going on behind the scenes that you think is maybe lost?
Well, that Berry Gordy didn't know what was being made is the first thing. You know, he knew everything that was going on at Motown. He didn't know that this song was being made. Eventually, Marvin would sing on it. And then, of course, he had his friends Mel Farr and Lem Barney. You know, you hear at the beginning of that song, those are their voices.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
And they were, they were part of the Detroit Lions at the time. And by the way, Marvin Gaye thought he wanted to be a football player and tried out for the Lions. And I think he got sacked a couple of times, and that sort of put that whole idea to bed. But they were his friends, and he brought them in. One of the other things that I should mention with this album, with this song, is that Marvin Gaye started to dress differently. So we hadn't seen him dress this way. We hadn't heard him sound this way. And it was just a complete shift for him. Also, one of the biggest things that Marvin Gaye did with the album, I know we're talking about the song, but this was the first time that the Funk Brothers and the artists and the other musicians that played on the album were actually credited so that we could see their names. And then, of course, the music itself. I should also mention one more thing, is that Marvin Gaye ended up using a technique of doubling and tripling his voice.
See, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
That was done on this song by accident.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today.
The engineer at the time recorded Marvin. He wanted to have two different versions of his own take to use. And they ended up getting sort of recorded together. And when Marvin heard it, he loved it. And so that was something that was different for this approach from a recording standpoint.
And this is a song that came out in 1971. Did it in some ways pave the way for what was going to come later from artists like Stevie Wonder and others that were suddenly going to put some very different and more personal and more political things in their writing and their music at Motown?
Certainly with this song and this different approach to making music at Motown, showed other artists what was possible. And it would have to open the eyes of Berry Gordy that things were changing. You know, the approach that Motown had taken for so long wasn't going to continue to work quite as well. And then, of course, comes the Temptations with their psychedelic era, and they were dealing with social issues as well. So, Marvin Gaye was very well respected, and this definitely had caused a shift. This album and this song caused a shift at Motown for sure.
What does it say to you that from 1971 to 2021, the song still feels so relevant?
Well, that's another conversation altogether. It speaks to our society. It speaks to the fact that we are still wrestling with some of the same issues that inspired Marvin Gaye to write this song. So it would tell me that we have a lot of work to do still. But the fact that this song resonates with people and that they still love the performance of it and the message of it, that's the beautiful part of music. You know, it can stand the test of time and reflect our thoughts and our feelings about what's going on in our society. You know, we're always kind of amazed when we say about this song, and this was, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we always say, oh, this song could have been written today. That's the sort of sobering part of it, is that it is still so relevant today, and we would have hoped that we would have gotten past a lot of the things that Marvin Gaye was addressing and was inspired by to write this song. So we have some work to do.
Ann DeLisi of Ann DeLisi's Essential Music on WDET. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you tomorrow.